Welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Today is the 25th annual Prisoners' Justice Day. Prisoners mark this day as a day of peaceful protest against all of the unnecessary deaths behind bars. For the next hour, we'll bring you an in-depth look at the prison system from the perspectives of prisoners and prison justice activists. This is Behind Bars, Behind the Mic. It is a co-production between CJSF 90.1 FM and Letters for the Inside, an SFU student group doing research for inmates. Over the next hour, we'll hear voices and music from a women's prison choir, a former corrections officer's reflections on his past role in the prison system, but first, we'll hear insight into girls' experiences in prison. The following was produced by Mandavni Dami.
My name is Asha Tapska, and I'm an advocate and coordinator at Justice for Girls Outreach Society, and I've been working with the organization for over 10 years.
Thanks for joining us, Asha.
Oh, no worries. Thank me. I appreciate it.
So I'm just going to ask you, what are some of the major issues that Justice for Girls has dealt with or worked around with regards to the conditions that incarcerated girls are facing?
Well, for about 5 years, until 3 years ago, which I will talk about later, we worked with girls mostly at the Burnaby Youth Custody Center. And what we would do is we would do outreach with girls once a month. So we would speak to a large group of girls about their human rights, about their rights within the child welfare system, when dealing with the police, and also within the prisons. And after that, we would do individual visits and do advocacy with girls. So there are many issues that related to prisoner justice that girls spoke to us about and that we dealt with over those years. For example, for years, girls and boys were shackled during sweat lodge ceremonies at the youth prison. Justice for Girls, along with a number of Aboriginal organizations, youth organizations, got together, and we challenged the fact that this racist practice was going on at the prison in Burnaby, and as a result of that, the prison actually did change their policy, because they actually had a policy that allowed shackling during sweat lodges, not during other programs and other kinds of ceremonies, but during sweat lodges specifically. So that was one of our, along with other groups, one of the successes that we were able to accomplish. The other issues we worked around was, for example, staffing by male guards. For a really long time, male guards were able to staff girls' units, so girls' living units, which was extremely problematic. Girls would complain about sexual harassment. We made a complaint on behalf of one young woman, for example, when a guard would lift the would lift the covering over her cell door window and looked at her when she was undressing, things like that. Mm-hmm. So we made complaints on many issues over the years. We worked with girls who were obviously who were assaulted by guards, tried to get some form of justice for them. We really did a lot of work, and we have for years advocated that girls and boys should be separated in custody, because there were also situations, especially at the Youth Custody Center in Victoria, where there, it used to be that there was a girl cell, guy cell, in Victoria Youth Custody, and largely, I would say, as a result of our work, to our knowledge, that's been stopped, and there was a separate girls' unit opened. Ultimately, we're not we don't want young women to be in prison. So ultimately, we're an abolitionist organization. But in the short term, we were dealing with basic prisoner and girls' human rights issues. And that all led to about 3 years ago, when we were at the Youth Custody Center in Burnaby, we were doing an outreach group with girls, and several young women, first of all, we started to talk to girls about the inpatient assessment unit, which is a psychiatric assessment unit that is on the grounds, or the old grounds that used to be on the old grounds of the Burnaby Youth Custody Center. And we started asking girls what it was like on that unit, because we'd heard from one young woman who was there alone with, I believe, 5 or 6 young men who were also being assessed, and she was the only girl, and she felt really uncomfortable being on that unit. And I remember she wanted to be moved off, so she wouldn't have to sleep there. She just wanted to be moved off at night. And we weren't able to succeed on that one. We couldn't get her moved. But when we did another outreach session, we asked girls, so what's it like at this assessment unit? And that's when several girls started talking about, the breast assessments are kind of weird. And myself and my colleague, who were there, we just looked at each other and we said, breast assessments, what do you mean? We're talking about girls who are obviously under 18, but sometimes much younger. And one of the young women who was speaking about this, the breast test, let's say, that she was talking about, happened when she was 13. And so, and the girl started talking, and the doctor was creepy, and one of the girls started talking about the young woman who was 13 at the time said that he basically just groped her breasts. And so that's when we made a complaint to the jail and to the inpatient assessment unit and to the Minister of Children and Families that there was a doctor who was abusive at the jail, and that these tests were going on, and that really breast exams for 13, 14, 15 year old girls are very questionable and should never be happening in during psychiatric assessments in custody. So at that point, we basically were, after a few weeks, we were, not maybe even less, we were banned from the jail. And that happened in July 3 years ago. So we effectively could not make phone calls to the jail. We couldn't we could make phone calls, but girls wouldn't get our calls. We were banned all access to speaking to or communicating with girls in the jails in BC, in the youth prisons. So since that time, we did a lot of work to try and get back into the prison to be able to do outreach to girls again, and we haven't been successful. The long answer to your question.
No, that was great. You've been talking a lot about some of the human rights violations, like some of the racist practices and the sexual harassment that girls are subjected to. Who is accountable for overseeing the conditions of incarceration in youth institutions? Who is responsible for monitoring these conditions?
That is a very good question. So first of all, the youth custody centers, the youth prisons, are the responsibility of the Ministry of Children and Family Development. So ultimately, they are the ones who are responsible. I don't know if many people know that. The Child Welfare Ministry runs the youth prisons. And as far as... So they are, ultimately, they are accountable. And who is responsible for monitoring is another question. Really, we don't have... we have very, very few independent advocates, and the advocate how to say this, there are several groups that now, including the Elizabeth Fry Society and John Howard Society, that get contracts from the Child Welfare Ministry to do advocacy or to work with youth in prisons, and the ministry will say that that form of advocacy is enough. We would say that advocates who get their contracts from the Ministry of Children and Families and work very, very close to the prisons are not real advocates for the young women that we work with, and that we've worked with in the past and who we know. The other form of recourse, possibly in British Columbia, is the representative for Children and Youth's office. The representative, Mary Turpel Lafont, her mandate is to oversee all of the issues of children in care, and so prisoner issues really are part of her mandate, but because there are so many issues, and because of course the child welfare system has so many failures for children and youth, her office isn't really fully able to do what they need to do, or what an advocacy organization would need to do to oversee the jail. So her office it does not have the advocates that it needs to have, and it's also a complaints-based process. What we would see is we would love to see something like prisoner legal services for girls and boys in custody. So the same way that there are prisoner legal services that mostly work with adults, so if adults are having problems in custody, legal human rights problems, then they can call prisoner legal services. We would love it if there was youth prisoner legal services for girls and boys in custody.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that means that, for example, that lawyers could do outreach and could say, we are here to represent you or to give you legal information, advice, if you experience some of these problems, some of these human rights breaches in custody.
Okay. Concerning, we've talked about, it's like some of the things that you're saying, like youth face different kinds of barriers in the prison justice system. I believe that the effects of human rights violations in the prison setting go beyond the borders of the prison. So,
yes.
Like, for example, a lot of the human rights violations that girls face in the prison setting are related to a lot of the structural problems and just a lot of the structural issues. So I was wondering what are some of the issues and concerns for girls coming out of prisons, and how reintegration and things like that are affected by human rights violations.
Okay. So I guess there are a few points to this one. First of all, young women usually might be in for short periods of time, repeatedly or several times. So what happens is often young women, we'd have to begin with why girls are criminalized and incarcerated in the first place. Often girls may be incarcerated for their own safety rather than to protect someone else from them. So, for example, if a young woman is living on the street, or she's on and off the street, she's homeless, and there is an older man who is providing her with drugs and sexually exploiting her, it might be that the court will put a no contact condition on her, saying that she cannot contact him, so that she is theoretically protected from this man. Let's say she has she has some minor charge for theft, and then she has a bunch of probation conditions, and one of those conditions ends up becoming no contact with so and so. And so often the beginning is that girls are are first in custody, often for their own protection, often from drugs and alcohol. Girls get conditions, you know, no go to the downtown east side, and in order to stop them or try and stop them from using drugs, they might be breached and put in custody. So when they exit custody, let's say they're breached and they're put in custody for 2 weeks, they are often in the same conditions that they began in when they entered. So in a lot of ways, they're facing male violence, they're facing drug addiction and homelessness. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that Justice for Girls is doing around girls, like supporting girls as they come out of prisons?
I think we provide advocacy to girls, for girls at any stage. So definitely, if we're working with low income and homeless girls, then they might have had charges at some point. They might have been in custody at some point. So it's not that they would necessarily be coming right out, but some would be. But I think we do the advocacy that we always would provide. So information about if what you're needing housing-wise, let's say, what you're needing from the Child Welfare Ministry, if there has been violence against her and she's been told she has to go to court and to appear and she doesn't want to appear, we might work with her and try and figure out what she can do and what her rights are and things like that, figure out her options.
What are some of the things that people can do to support your work and the work of Justice for Girls?
Oh, that's a good question. I think more generally the goal of human rights for girls and of equality for girls is something that you can maybe contribute to even without becoming directly involved with the organization. I think we have some ideas we wrote a book report called More Than Bricks and Mortar, which is all about homelessness and young women, and we have some ideas in there of what you can do to prevent homelessness of girls. And I think one of the things we say is, stand beside the young women that you know and the girls that you know in their lives, and believe girls when they tell you about things that are happening to them. You know, often girls maybe aren't believed when they come out about violence that's happening against them, and people don't stand beside them. And so, I think that's something you can do just for the women, the girls in your life, And as far as Justice for Girls, I just think the most important thing is to get more oversight over what is happening in the youth prisons. So we would love it if there was prisoner legal services for youth. If you are so inclined, if you'd like to write letters to probably the Attorney General about the need for legal services for youth. Okay. That would be great. But we will, we'll put more on our website as time goes, because I think that is gonna be one of our next big campaigns, is to get prisoner legal services for youth. So, and I mean, of course, you can donate if you're able to. But that's.
Thank you for speaking with us, Asha. It was great to have you. So we've been speaking with Asha from Justice for Girls today. For more information about the organization, visit their website, www.justiceforgirls.org.
You're listening to Behind Bars, Behind the Mic, a special co-production of CJSF 90.1 FM and Letters for the Inside, which is SFU's student group of researchers for inmates. My name is Peter Driftmeyer. I spoke with Anthony, who used to be a corrections officer in an Alberta provincial prison. I spoke with him about his experiences and observations on guard-inmate relationships and the dynamic among corrections officers. He began by telling me what training he received before starting that job.
I think that the training definitely wasn't adequate given what I encountered when I was placed in a gang unit. And there definitely was an educational component that, in retrospect, should have been added into the training phase. And for whatever reason, funding or whatever the case may be, that was definitely missing.
What kind of education was lacking? What would you have liked to have seen in there?
Well, I think that if you look at the prison population, there's definitely an overrepresentation of Aboriginal people. And in my experience, the way colonialism has worked in Canada, stereotypes still exist and thrive present day. And there wasn't enough done to educate us officers in terms of what some of the people that we were about to be dealing with, what they've experienced in their background and what maybe their parents and their parents' parents experienced. And that would have given some context to help explain where these people were currently at in terms of them deciding to lash out and deal inappropriately with the torment that they were experiencing. So some education in terms of the background of some of the people that we wound up working with that often we had to deal with in very, very violent and stressful situations, I think would have helped given myself and other officers an understanding of who these people, some of their background experiences, and maybe it would have allowed us to relate to them better. I think that there's a strong occurrence of a us versus them mentality in prisons. I can't speak to what the situation is like federally, but provincially, in my experience, what very quickly develops as a new officer is an understanding that your only means of support are the other officers around you, and that the inmates are basically out to get you. For myself, I pushed back against that mentality, and I quickly learned that that environment wasn't a place that I wanted to remain in. But overall, I think that issue continues, and it's something that one might find in police services and other positions where a person holds a great deal of power and I guess can opt either to learn about the people that they're dealing with or not and react to the people's behavior. My attitude or thinking is that, you know, it's important to proactively understand the people that one is dealing with in any job, but especially in a position where situations can become so so violent in a very short amount, in a very short period of time.
How would that us versus them mentality come through in those high stress situations? They have the right to use force. Does that end up coming out more when that mentality is such a part of how they deal with
prisoners? Definitely. The idea of solidarity amongst officers, in my experience, not just in corrections, but in other law enforcement contexts, it basically creates a situation where if, for example, if an officer escalates a behavior that an inmate is exuding, the officer, you know, during a shift or after a shift, might go to the other officers and explain that this inmate is an individual who needs to be taught a lesson, or who needs to be dealt with by others in the same manner that he's dealt with them. And as a result, of course, if you don't treat that individual the way, say, that officer, who typically would be senior to yourself if they're directing you to deal with someone in a certain way, you're pretty much forced into a position where you have to respond or face alienation from your fellow officers. So, of course, my method was to talk to the inmates and actively listen to them and try to gain an understanding of what the situation was that they were facing. Sometimes their behavior, they wouldn't, for example, often in the gang unit I worked in, an inmate wouldn't want to come out and say, I'm scared for my life. I feel another inmate is going to shank me. He would feel that that would be some sort of sign of weakness. And as a result, he'd opt to commit some sort of infraction in order to get him sent to segregation or get kicked out of the unit that he was in and placed somewhere else, just as means of self-protection. So basically, it was very important for me to try to understand where these people were coming from, not simply just deal with their outward behavior. But like I said, often your hands are tied when every other officer around you is willing to engage in that sort of senseless response to an individual's behavior.
That must have been really hard to maintain given that culture amongst the officers.
Right. And there were some very noble officers that I worked with. But the problem is, of course, there are people who go into these law enforcement jobs seeking power. And when they attain that power, or past experiences where someone's hurt them, say another inmate has hurt them in some way, they'll attribute that and connect that to other inmates. And so you're placed in a situation where, like I explained, the us versus them mentality develops very quickly, and you're either part of the group or you're not. And if you're an officer in any field of law enforcement, getting support from your fellow officers is very important, because at times you are a target just simply due to the fact that you're wearing a uniform. And if you're not part of that group, I've heard stories from others where that support that they need isn't there to be found. There was a point in which I decided that field that work wasn't what I was interested in continuing, and I left. But I know for others who have done their best to maintain their own values and ethics, it has been problematic for them in terms of their relations with other officers.
For as an officer, are you would counseling or some other form of support be provided for all the emotional stuff that you would all go through in dealing with having all that power and having to resort to violence at times?
Right. There are, working for the government, there are support services in place where one can make use of meaningful resources to help them, to help mitigate against those issues that they're facing or experiences that they're dealing with. But in my experience, it was more so a situation with where you deal with a violent situation and everyone would go for drinks after and get drunk and drown their worries in alcohol. And substance abuse was a huge issue at the center where I worked at. There were quite a few cases where I knew of officers that were taking time off due to alcoholism. And of course, when one is dealing with an addiction like that, their conduct with others is affected, can't help but be affected, which creates a really difficult situation in terms of these individuals who were there to support basically. Often it isn't, it doesn't become a form of support, it becomes a form of oppression and aggressive action, just due to an individual's their own life circumstance, where they're not happy with what's occurring in their own lives.
No kidding. Now, can you give us a picture of what some of the kind of worst case scenarios would be for seeing officers not respond in the right way to things they'd have to do with prisoners, like worst case scenarios of violence against prisoners or such?
Right. Well, I often experience situations where rather than de-escalating an individual that was portraying undesirable behavior, say they were shouting at someone or they weren't willing to go and lock up, that was always an issue, the officer would opt to threaten the individual rather than attempt to talk to them one-on-one and try to delve into why it is that they were behaving in the way that they were. And often that would lead to the individual being pepper sprayed or the tactical team being called in to deal with that person. And of course, there'd be a domino effect where the other inmates in the unit would observe this. And of course, for them to see someone being manhandled and assaulted in the way that the individual would be at times, it led to their behaviors or to their behavior being affected in a negative way, as well as them being scared and fearful for their own safety, not just in terms of an attack from other inmates, but an attack from the guards themselves, the officers themselves. There were situations where individuals were handcuffed and beaten. I never partook in that, but there were situations that I recall that I definitely don't look back on in a favorable way. Some of those scenes definitely haunt me, and created a situation in which I wasn't comfortable working in that environment any longer. The power is all on the side of correction officers and administration. An individual, at least where I was working, could be charged and for a whole variety of minor reasons, and it was the officer's duty to justify their actions. But often I experienced situations where the officer was the aggressor and the individual defended himself, and then following the individual, the inmate being assaulted, there were charges brought up against the individual to justify the officer's actions. And again, the majority of the individuals that I worked with were fairly ethical in terms of their treatment of the inmates, but there was definitely select individuals, as I recall, that were not. And being, say, senior officers, they weren't challenged in any way by other officers or by administration.
So does the policy allow for that, or is it something that they were just able to kind of weasel their way through the system and get away with it?
Well, in my experience, officer accountability was definitely lacking. There weren't enough CCTV cameras, or there should have been CCTV cameras in every area. Every area should have been covered. Because there weren't, there were certain areas where an inmate could be brought to and beat in that manner. Of course, if it were to, if it had occurred in the open, within range of CCTV surveillance, one would hope that the individual would seek legal representation and go after the officer and the government for what occurred. But there definitely were environmental issues where they could have made the environment more secure for the inmates and for the officers, of course, too. It works both ways.
So they were able to get away with it mostly because of lack of evidence proving otherwise.
Right, and the availability for them to justify their actions in the form of charges brought against the inmates. An inmate could be charged for swearing at an officer, for not complying with an officer's directions. There's a whole range of ways in which an officer could justify aggressive behavior against an inmate. And of course, you know, there were situations where officers and other inmates were violently attacked without the aggressor being provoked in any way. So it, of course, it was important for there to be a system in which the inmate would be held accountable for their actions. However, in my experience, those in power often use the system to their benefit more so than an inmate's ability to use the rules that were in place.
Yeah. Can I get your sense of whether you think that the system as you saw it was as rehabilitative as it could be?
No, I don't think that, at least provincially, the correction center that I worked in was doing anything to rehabilitate the individual. I feel that it likely made the inmates more frustrated and increased their feeling of alienation from society. Of course, proof is in the pudding. If you look at recidivism rates, the correction system definitely isn't doing what it is there to do, which is, in essence, to protect society and to offer assistance to people who, or support to people who have opted to commit crimes that negatively affect, that really impact others. And the system should definitely be, the correction system should be more open to education of their officers, number one, and to give the officers a better understanding of who it is that they're dealing with. And thus, one would hope that officers would be able to establish more meaningful relationships with the inmates that they deal with and be better equipped to support them in more positive ways and not be so quick, of course, to anger and to perpetuate that us versus them way of thinking.
Well, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Awesome. Thank you.
That was Anthony, a former corrections officer in an Edmonton provincial prison. You're listening to Behind Bars, Behind the Mic, a special co-production of CJSF 90.1 FM and Letters for the Inside, which is SFU's student group of researchers for inmates. The following was produced by Leah Abramson.
My name is Leah Abramson, and I'm a musician and songwriter based in Vancouver. In high school, I was labeled a so-called youth at risk, and I did some pretty stupid things, and I got caught sometimes, but I also got away with a lot. I was also lucky enough to have my parents put me in music lessons when I was a kid, and they bought me my first guitar when I was a teenager. And once I started writing songs, it gave me something to pour my energy into, and I basically stopped putting myself at risk. But what if my family didn't have money for lessons or instruments? Or what if my love of music had never been noticed or encouraged? And if those choices had never even existed for me? What would I be doing now, and where would I be? A few years ago, with this in mind, I started volunteering as a music teacher at the Fraser Valley Institution, or FVI, a federal prison for women in Abbotsford, BC. The following music and interviews were recorded inside the prison during a song workshop in June and then a recording session on July 24th, 2010. I hear Jennifer. Hey.
Might have to make room for the big drum.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Dave.
Hi, Dave. I'm Jennifer. I'm the one singing right now.
Okay.
I'm Hannah. I'm the keeper.
She's my drum keeper, our drum keeper of the institution.
What we're going to need to do is, when we're ready to go, we're going to close the door and everyone's going to have to be super quiet.
Quiet, yeah. Yeah.
Kind of start singing in a choir when you were younger and then like kind of stop in between until you got here? Or was it music a part of your life in any way but in between?
Yeah, even throughout my life I've always turned to music, right? And it's always been like my own way of, like, not escape, but it helps self-soothe myself, right? And I had like I didn't have an easy life, right? Mm-hmm. So in my life, music helps me like relax, or, you know, like when I'm angry, I listen to music, you know? And I'm sure it works like that for many people, and it doesn't matter what kind of life you live, it helps a lot of people express their feelings, right? My mom's family was like alone, like from her own family, like that she was separated from her sisters and brothers. She's youngest, and her sister was her best friend, and ever since her sister died, my mom was kind of alone, and she raised us alone. We just had each other, basically, and I think that's why we're so, like, close, and, I don't know, we're really tight, our family. I think that's probably why I wanted to sing was because of my mom. Yeah, and in our culture, it's just a spiritual thing for me, too, right? But music will always be part of my life, and even if it's just like my mom heard me singing that song on the phone to her, and she said she wished she had it on a CD so she could replay it over and over, right? And that's why I'm doing it, right?
After I graduated from high school, I was an anti-globalization activist. I went to protests and held up signs. I wanted the world to be a better place, and I wanted to do my part. But eventually I was disillusioned with protests and stopped doing anything political. Instead, I just concentrated on playing and writing music. I felt like nothing I did made a difference anyway. But I got sick of doing nothing, and at the same time, I also realized that music affects people way more than protest signs.
I just go by D. D? Okay. Yeah. Did Jen's
already
hear us?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's great.
Where are you going? She came and got me, or I probably wouldn't have made it here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I live in the Slee now, and you have to have a guard coming at me. You can't just come to my door like all the other houses are here.
Okay.
I don't play well with other women. And there's 60 in here.
So have you been writing songs for a while then?
Yeah, I've been writing songs since the 80s.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a pretty big book full of them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that can... I have a topic and the whole song spills out. If I don't write it down, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look at things and add things to it or take things away from it. It just comes out.
So music in your life now is like pretty
central. Music's my God. It's the universal language, and it's the one thing that I have that's mine, right? That nobody can take away from me. No matter where I am or what I'm doing, I can still hear music on the radio. I can still, even in here, I buy CDs, and that's my time for me. I put those headphones on, and I relax, and I can write a letter. I can write lyrics. I can do whatever I want, and I can block the whole world out if I want to. And after the death of my son in January, if it wasn't for that music, I probably would have been, and here, I probably would have been back on the street. And not that I made a habit of it, because I came in here clean and healthy and happy, but your past always catches up with you. And there's nothing better than putting on a set of Bose headphones and listening to classical Bach or Beethoven. Right? Some people look at me and go, ooh. But I used to sing opera too, so I love opera too. Right?
Sorry, where were you singing?
In Caribou.
Okay.
It was a hotel that's torn down now. But we had a band called The Majestic Experience, and we had a lot of fun with it, a lot of fun.
Nice.
And I used to sing like top 10 in the 80s, right?
That's awesome.
And now my voice is so much deeper because of all the smoking and, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, I miss it. So I'm now starting to get my voice back through choral and here, right?
That's awesome.
So yeah, it's always been a dream of mine. My attitude's always, if you want something bad enough with all your heart, you can get it. And I did. I was just about to cut a record before I got bronchial pneumonia.
Well, I was looking out the window, saw him standing there. I remember the familiar look in his eyes, soft colors in his hair. As I slowly opened the door, love began to grow, watching him standing there, his head bent very low.
I first met Teresa just over a year ago when I helped put together a small choir for a multimedia art project at FVI. Teresa was the most dedicated member, and she always stayed late to show us all the songs she was working on. And I'm really excited for Teresa and all the other women involved in this project, because now their music is recorded and they can share it with loved ones and everyone else on the outside.
My name's Teresa, and the song is called Rainbows, and it came to me at a time in my life where I was going through a lot of growth and change.
Spiritual journey for myself. I just feel like there's been a tremendous amount of healing in my life since I started playing a year ago. I can't help but kind of believe that it is connected to the music in my life.
So you took piano lessons like when you were younger, right?
When I was 3 and 4 years
really?
Old. Yeah.
That long ago?
Very young. And then I didn't play until I was 28. I couldn't play two hands on a keyboard. I couldn't play anymore. So
that's amazing that you've really come a long way.
Yeah, I made a lot of progress here. I picked it up quickly, and I think it's because I played when I was, like, I had that, just that little bit of a memory attached to it. And when I started playing in here, it was a hard time in my sentence. I was going through some really heavy programs. I was searching for a stronger sense of self. I had these really fond memories of playing when I was a little kid, and a sadness that I had stopped. So when I started playing again, and I realized that I could play, and that I was still pretty good at playing, it was very strengthening and, like, extremely comforting.
I will not let these fears,
my name is Leah Abramson, and I'm going to be playing some music for you that was recorded at the Fraser Valley Institution in Abbotsford, BC. I'm going to be playing music from the drum circle at the institution. They have about 5 or 6 members, and they get together and play songs from the different Aboriginal traditions of the women who live in the institution. So we're going to start off with a song called The Friendship Song. Was the FVI drum circle with the Friendship Song. Next up, we're going to hear a song called P for W, and afterwards we'll hear an explanation of the song by the women who drummed it.
Yeah. last one we sang was P4W. It's from Kingston, Ontario, in the Women's Federal Prison. It came from the elder Ellen Mooshkamp. Mm-hmm. She passed away a couple years ago. She gave this song to the women. It's just to honor the fallen sisters who have
committed suicide or who have been abused, hurt in that prison, because there was a lot of negativity going on with the guards, corruptness, and a lot of women have fallen from that. So the song is for her, for them, all of them.
Because our institution right now wouldn't be the way it is if it wasn't for them.
You mean this institution's a lot better?
Oh, yeah.
This institution is awesome compared to the other penitentiaries. Mm-hmm. A lot of women become
hard and violent.
Yeah, hard and violent, and that's the only way they know how to survive when they come out of jail. So they're institutionalized when they leave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here it's more relaxed. It's more like summer camp.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. We all have houses, mm-hmm. and we're able to cook our own food, and we have access to the elder.
Yeah.
And to the chaplain, we can go to the culture room, the library. We don't have to wait for staff to come get us. We are able to leave our houses when we want. Mm-hmm. We have a kennel.
Yeah, we have dogs here. We can take care of the dogs. And that's also a good program for us, too. We wouldn't have had that either if it wasn't for our fallen sisters.
We have construction courses, one that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. They're, house 10 and house 11 got built by us. Our healthcare got built by us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to Edmonton or to Kitchener, Ontario, or Nova, Juliet, I'm pretty sure they do not have these programs there. Mm-hmm. So this song is just to honor the women who put up with everything that they've had to deal with,
mm-hmm.
and who are essentially looking after us right now.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. And now you're going to hear a song called The David Song by the same group. This has been a short broadcast of songs by the Drum Circle of the Fraser Valley Institution in Abbotsford.
That was produced by Leah Abramson. This has been Behind Bars, Behind the Mic, a special co-production of CJSF 90.1 FM and Letters for the Inside, which is SFU's student group of researchers for inmates. If you would like more information on Letters for the Inside, you can reach them at letters@sfpirg.ca. If you would like more information on Prisoners' Justice Day, you can visit prisonjustice.ca. The music you've heard in this production was by the Abramson Singers, and the song was Call It Something Else.